Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The crop acreage report, you can sort of think of it like ground truthing the other information that we have access to. We've got a lot of data from the NAS survey or census that goes out every 5 years. We've got a lot of information that's gathered from the available sources through the Economic Research Service. And this is actually producer-submitted information. So in many cases, it's probably the best information we've got.
Zach Ducheneau is the administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency.
And all of that together informs our policymaking at the FSA. And it's important to stress that the best information available will create the best policy possible. Without crop acreage reports, NAS census and survey data, and ERS reports, we may miss the mark in some of our policy construction and policy delivery.
This is Agriculture Today.
First look at condition for spring wheat. Not a terrible picture.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA, taking a look at spring wheat conditions.
We don't have a comparison for last week or last year, so I could just say that we're sitting at 64% good to excellent, 2% very poor to poor. In terms of drought, the real focus is on the Northwest, keeping an eye on Washington State, for example, where 10% of the crop, highest in the nation, is rated very poor to poor.
So let's move from wheat now to corn and soybeans, and what's the budgets look like? Gary Schnitke, University of Illinois.
We have seen commodity prices, corn and soybean prices, fall for fall delivery. For example, we've seen the Chicago Mercantile Exchange contract, the December 2023 contract, go from a level of 591 in February, when we set the projected price for crop insurance, down to 5 to 520. Similarly, we've seen the soybean contract, November contract, go from 1376 in February, again where we set the projected price for crop insurance, and that is now trading at $12. Much of that reason for that decline is good weather in Brazil and fast planting in the United States, although we still have a good ways to go before we know what yields look like for 2023. The Office of Chief Economist of the U.S. Department of Agriculture released their first release of 2023 market year average prices. That would be their estimate of average prices across the U.S. And it was $4.80 for corn for 2023 compared to $6.75 for 2022. Soybean prices are projected at $12.10, down from $14.35. We revised our 2023 crop budgets as a result of these price declines, and we came up with, for Central Illinois, an operator and land return of $307 per acre. That is below the average cash rent for Central Illinois high productivity land of $363 per acre, or a $56 loss on cash rent farmland at the average cash rent. The last time we saw losses was in 2014 and 2015. Now, $5 corn prices and $12.50 soybean prices causes loss. So, in some sense, we're back to normal. We're back to the 2014 through 2019 period after the high returns of 2021 and 2022. We do not expect that to cause much stress in 2023 because we've seen financial buildup on farms, but it does cause us to think about what we need to do for 2024 production. Coming into August, if we see prices below $5 for corn and $12.50 for soybeans, we have to begin to think about making serious adjustments, and in particular to cash rent. On the other hand, if we see prices in the $5 to $6 range for corn and $12.50 to $13.50, we'll be okay. That could happen if we have any yield shortfalls across the United States. And if we see prices above $6 for corn and $13.50 for soybeans, we're likely to have a reasonable year for 2024. So we can have a good harvest season and Christmas, but again, we have risk out there, and you might want to use variable cash rents.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Right now, we're going to categorize youth marketing into Gen Z. These are consumers that were born between 1995 and 2009. So I'll do the math for you. They're 12 to 26 years of age. And by the way, I have three of them in my household, so a good sampling.
Kim Kitchens is Senior Vice President, Consumer Marketing with Cotton Incorporated.
And when we talk about youth marketing at Cotton Incorporated, we're really talking about the 12-year-old to about the 21 into college and the opportunities we have there. We don't typically go beyond 12 because of legal issues and reaching them in the media areas. So let's talk a little bit about who this market is in totality, though, in Gen Z. This is the first generation to be born with technology literally in the palm of their hand and social media. They are the most diverse generation of any generation we've seen culturally, ethnically, racial, and religious. And when we look at some of the things they've been through, and just in the past year alone, the global pandemic, they've been through a global recession, and they've seen significant social and even climate change, and that's a pun on words in a variety of ways, on what they have access to and the type of information and more choices than any other generation before. And all of this impacts how we market or we reach out to this generation. I do like to underscore, too, their influence or purchasing power. And Gen Z currently commands about $143 billion in buying power. And this is about 40% of total consumer spending. So it's something to certainly be considerate of. And again, as they age, they will take on more of that. And the last point I'll make on this slide for you is that 93% of Gen Z parents say that they influence their decisions. So it's not just Gen Z you're targeting necessarily. Many times it's the parents too.
So one question is, why does Generation Z or Gen Z even matter to the cotton industry?
And what this chart is showing you is that Generation Z, the yellow bar, checks label at a lesser rate or a lower rate than what we see in Y and X. And the concern about that is that if you looked at Generations X and Y when they were the same age as Generation Z, Generation Z is still significantly lower. So we need to influence this market and to get them up to standards. So the good news is, so at X and Y, they're almost equivalent now at how often they're looking at labels. Now, this doesn't mean, though, that Generation Z doesn't love cotton. In fact, the majority say it's their favorite fiber, which is good, and 6 out of 10 are aware of the seal of cotton. So there's already a foundation here to continue to work with and target this market. But the younger the consumer, the least likely they are to say this unaided.
Trying to read a teenager's mind is pretty difficult, but what do teens want?
First and foremost is fit. Will it fit me? How will it look? That's important impressions. Then price. And it's interesting because all generations, except for this one, price is number one. So what's close to the heart is the wallet and what that can do for them. Then other aspects, comfort, which we know cotton owns comfort, style, quality, and durability. Now, you will see on the bottom of this chart currently is eco-friendly, but I'm going to talk more about that in a moment because this is what first comes to their mind and what they say matters to them related directly to clothing, not just the environment. The other point I wanted to make on this chart is that bricks trump clicks. And that means that Generation Z still prefers to shop in store when buying apparel items. 64%, in fact. And it's not just apparel. It's almost all goods other than computers and gaming. So there's also opportunity to influence them at the point of purchase and when it really matters about what they're looking for in apparel.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Subcommittee on Communications and Technology will come to order.
Representative Bob Latta from Ohio is the chairman of the House Subcommittee on Communications. On Tuesday, holding a hearing on AM radio.
Again, thank you very much to our witnesses for being here today to examine the importance of AM radio receivers and vehicles. AM radio has been an integral part of our society for well over a century, connecting Americans to local news and serving as the backbone to our nation's emergency communications infrastructure.
The hearing prompted by an announcement from Ford that they would discontinue AM radios in new vehicles.
Over 45 million Americans tune into AM radio each month. They rely on it for local news, weather, sports, and emergency alerts. Its unique frequency characteristics allow signals to travel far and wide, overcoming geographical barriers and reaching both urban and remote areas. This makes AM radio an invaluable tool during times of crisis. When hurricanes, tornadoes, or other natural disasters strike, AM radio remains steadfast, providing vital information to those in affected areas when other communication channels fail. In fact, a few years ago when I was traveling through my district, when I came on the radio, there was a tornado on the ground. I switched to my local AM radio station playing in real-time weather alerts that allowed me to know the exact path of the tornado. With that information, I was able to safely travel home, avoiding the storm's path. In times of emergency, information is power, and AM radio remains a primary source for emergency reports. Local broadcasters have long served as the trusted voice delivering real-time updates, weather alerts, evacuation instructions, and other critical information that can mean the difference between life and death. Beyond emergency situations, AM radio plays a key role in local news and community engagement. From news and cultural events to sports coverage and talk shows, AM radio keeps us connected to our communities. These stations provide a platform for discussion, education, and entertainment. Importantly, AM radio reaches a wide demographic, ranging from seniors to rural and underserved communities. It serves as a source of information that is accessible to all, regardless of socioeconomic status or access to the Internet. Today's hearing is a result of announcements made by many auto manufacturers that they intend to remove AM radio in certain vehicles due to the interference between the AM radio receivers and batteries in electric car vehicles. As some manufacturers shared in response to a letter I led last month with my colleague, the gentleman from Indiana's 6th District, the electromagnetic waves emitted by an electric vehicle's battery interfere with the incoming AM radio waves, causing the sound to buzz and fade. To solve this interference, some auto manufacturers are installing shields and filters to protect the receiver against this interference. In other cases, it appears that cars are equipping their new models with AM radio capability but have it disabled. However, some automakers are considering or are actively removing AM radio receivers from new vehicles altogether, regardless of engine type. I look forward to hearing from our witnesses today about the public safety dangers of removing AM radio and possible solutions to combating signal interference. Removing AM radio receivers from vehicles means individuals may miss out on critical life-saving updates. We must ensure that no community is left behind, no voice is silenced, and no emergency response is compromised.
During that hearing, nearly every single member of the subcommittee weighing in on the importance of AM radio. Ford has announced they are turning that option back on in those vehicles. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Given the fairly unique experience with inflation, about 18 months ago, we started adding questions to the Meat Demand Monitor, asking folks, what do you expect? You know, higher, no change, or low change prices, specifically for ribeye, steak, ground beef, pork chop, and bacon next month.
Dr. Glenn Tonser is a Kansas State livestock economist talking about the Meat Demand Monitor.
And we've summarized that each month in the MDM, and all the raw data is there for, you know, my fellow geeks out there that want to go pull it up. What I included here for our talking points was in May, folks are expecting a 1.5% to 2% increase in June in those retail prices of those two beef and two pork prices that we track. That is right on trend with the last couple months, but what's most important here is it's well below what the expectations a year ago were. Expectations a year ago were 3 to 3.5%, you know, increases the upcoming month, consistent with we were living through 6 to 10% inflation, depending on who's measuring what time you talk about it. So expectations for higher meat prices are there, but the rate of those increases indeed has moderated a lot in the last few months.
He also talks about meat demand over time.
Both retail and food service domestic meat demand peaked in the middle of 2022 and was declining notably as we got to April of 2023, which was the latest data in this report. That decline was notable, but importantly, in April of 23, demand was still above what it was when we launched the project in February of 2020. So we've had a notable decline from the peak, but demand is still above what it was sort of pre-pandemic. That's important because context matters here. You know, I truly believe demand has slipped in the last 12 months, but context is important that it's not like the, you know, people are running away from beef, pork, and chicken. They still want to have meat protein in their diets, But another thing we track is your household financial situation. And about 80% of the public, specifically in April of 23, told us their household finances are the same or worse than they were a year earlier. I mean, there's only 20% that said their finances have improved. That allows us to segment meat demand and meat consumption and importance of price and a lot of other things by those different cohorts. Are, has your finances improved? Are they the same? Are they worse? And there's a very strong relationship, and that's not surprising. The segment of the public, and again, it's about 20%, that say their finances have improved have much higher rates of including beef and pork in their prior day meals. They have much stronger domestic beef and pork demand. Again, we'd expect that 100%, but it's good to confirm it with data like this. And conversely, those, particularly those that say their finances have weakened in the last year, are sort of the opposite. You know, we don't see, you know, stronger meal inclusion in beef and pork demand. But I'll also add in here, the relative importance of price in their protein purchasing decision is a lot higher if you say your finances have eroded. But what I was trying to highlight for Tyne in the U.S. Farm Report was we have a lot of diversity on the financial situation, which leads to a lot of diversity in realized meat demand in our country. It's easy to forget we have over 300 million people. You know, we are diverse in every metric you can think of, and it's easy to overlook. There's very strong ribeye demand by some, and there's incredibly weak ribeye demand by some. And the same thing for ground and for pork chops and so forth. We need to understand that and, you know, just be aware of that in general.
And he also explains why it's important to know what's happening with the competition.
The political situation and the regulatory situation around Proposition 12 in California is of note. I'm teeing this up because I'm en route to go to World Pork Expo and speak on some of those things, and I'm happy to do that. I mean, don't take the comments the wrong way. But our listeners here that are beef and cattle focused should also be aware of the profitability situation, kind of the disruptions in the domestic pork market and what that might mean for beef, regulatory uncertainty across state borders, what that might mean for your operation and so forth. It's always good to at least be aware of that.
Dr. Glenn Tonser, Kansas State Livestock Economist. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You all have done phenomenal work in promoting trade and opportunities for corn, sorghum, barley, ethanol, and DDGs.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, 2 years ago, speaking to the U.S. Grains Council at their annual summer meeting.
And you did a particularly good job of working with the ATP funding that was given to you several years ago and expanding opportunities and creating a chance for us to trade in as many as 79 countries. I'm told that you also used this opportunity to actually expand, which the whole purpose of the ATP funding was to expand into markets that we hadn't perhaps been as aggressive. And you all were able to get into 16 additional markets. That's a phenomenal record. And I think it's because you understand the secret sauce of trade. And it's really three things. It's first and foremost having presence in these markets. It's incredibly important for us to have people in country who understand and appreciate the significance of American agriculture, the tremendous productivity, the sustainably produced products that we can produce. It's important for folks to be in country, and you're helping to fund the presence of people who have a relationship with U.S. Ag. You also understand the importance of partnerships. It's important, again, to have activities and connections with customers, with universities, with a number of other factors in these countries to create the kind of partnerships. So there is an opportunity for people to hear from people in the country the importance of doing business with U.S. agriculture. And, of course, you also engage in promotions, being able to market what we grow and raise in this country. And, boy, what a great story we have to tell about what we grow and raise in this country. And I think it's also true that you've also been able to adjust to the new reality that we deal with in COVID, as we deal with not just in-person opportunities, but also virtual opportunities. I know when I was at US DEC, we had a number of virtual trade shows, which were pretty successful. And we're looking for creative and new ways to get the message out about US agriculture. And you all are at the forefront of that.
At the time, Congress debating an infrastructure package.
I think we're really, really close to the bipartisan infrastructure proposal. Despite the press suggestions that we're not, I think folks are getting very, very close. I'm hoping that maybe today there's an announcement of a finalized deal. And that really impacts trade. I think you all know this, but sometimes people forget that when you improve the highway system, you improve the rail system, you invest in inland waterways, and you significantly expand and improve our ports, you are essentially giving us a economic advantage in trade relationships. We are able to trade commodities at a competitive price, in large part because we're able to get those commodities to market less expensively than some of our competitors. And some of our competitors have realized that, and over the course of the last several years, they have begun to invest in infrastructure, invest in an effort to try to catch up. So this Build Back Better bipartisan infrastructure bill could allow us to make an historic investment in that transportation system, which will ensure that for a number of generations that we will continue to keep that edge, that competitive edge, that will allow us to continue to do more trade.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
My constituents in Eastern Washington rely on AM radio.
Kathy McMorris Rogers is the chairwoman of the House Energy Committee from Washington at a recent subcommittee hearing on AM radio.
It's how they hear the news in their communities, listen to sports, and receive information during emergencies. In many parts of my district, FM radio is spotty, and there's no access to broadband. So AM radio is the only option, which is why it's concerning that some vehicle manufacturers have taken steps recently to remove AM radios from new car models. This is in part a result of the Biden administration's rush to a green agenda as they push for electric vehicles, because electric vehicle batteries cause interference to AM frequencies, resulting in bad reception. The decision to remove AM radio from cars would affect tens of millions of Americans. Some estimates suggest that more than 45 million Americans tune in to AM radio each month. While people in some parts of the country have been able to take advantage of alternative options in vehicles for accessing AM radio, like through a streaming service, many parts of the country still lack access to reliable broadband services, meaning this option is unavailable. That includes people in my community who are raising the alarm and sending the message that they like AM radio. They're concerned that they would lose access to vital information services like the National Public Warning System. Unlike its FM counterpart, AM radio signals travel long distances and pass through obstacles such as buildings, hills, and dense vegetation. These characteristics ensure that potentially life-saving information reaches a large audience, especially in rural areas with limited access to other forms of communication. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, has also worked to reinforce AM radio base stations to mitigate risk resulting from events like natural disasters. And rural communities in particular rely on the service provided by AM radio, especially when they have only limited access to high-speed broadband and stream services, or they don't have any access at all. These services are important. They're important for farmers and ranchers who use AM radio to receive information on the weather, crop reports, and other vital information for their livelihoods. AM radio fosters a sense of local identity, connecting people through regional programming that reflects the unique perspectives and traditions of their communities. Local media on AM radio is closer to the people, telling the stories and sharing the perspectives that the national news doesn't always cover and sometimes ignores. And it plays a crucial role in government accountability, acting as a watchdog for local school boards, county officials, regional courts, and other government bodies. Further, AM radio continues to be a key outlet for talk radio shows to connect with audiences across the country. Rush Limbaugh, for example, had around 15 million listeners tuning in each week to his show, which was broadcast across 650 stations at its peak. These are vital sources of information that keep people engaged and connected to their local community, region, and voices and perspectives they value in their lives. Whether they're tuning in for the local news, agricultural, or weather reports, information during an emergency, or to listen to their favorite talk show personality, AM radio continues to be a popular way for Americans to stay connected.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The news is much better across the South. You take a look, for example, at the U.S. cotton production area. As recently as March, before the planting season began, we saw nearly half of the U.S. cotton production area considered to be in drought. We actually saw a spring peak of 47%, but most of that predated the planting time. Since planting has begun, we have seen rains picking up across many of those Southern Plains cotton production areas. We, of course, have had the drought relief in California.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
Elsewhere in the South, this is the first time in a long time that we've had 0% of the U.S. rice crop considered to be in a drought area. So that means that all of our California, our Western Gulf of Mexico, and our Delta rice production areas, all completely free of drought as we head into the heart of the rice growing season.